once again to Food Toxicology, and I'm Greg Muller. I'm on the instructor for this course. Today's lecture, what we're going to do is talk about the next step in the discussion of food toxicology, sources, pathways, receptors, and controls, and we're going to deal with some of the pathways. We followed last time what happens in terms of crossing that incredible barrier system in absorption from the chemical side to the biological side to the essentially physical to the organismal side in terms of toxicology. Well, what's next is the question that we are going to try to address in today's lecture in terms of the distribution and storage. For example, we've all had an insect bite, a fairly localized impact in terms of a skin irritation. Many of us have not, on the other hand, had a snake bite where there's an injection of a toxin or a venom that actually has not only localized impact but systemic impact throughout the body, and sometimes within rapid period of time and with fairly dramatic consequences. So we're going to talk about the distribution and storage of toxicants, and this as a predisposition of the types of toxicosis, the types of disease that we may get with a sufficient level of dose. Our learning objectives here today, we're going to try to identify some of the ways that toxicants are distributed in the body. What gives us the ability to have an ingestion and absorption through the skin, yet have consequences in organs, organelles, at distant sites in the organism? We're going to try as well to recognize the relationship between the route of absorption and the pathway for distribution. Obviously, as we've said, in respiration, we breathe, and in fact, the gas exchange across that very large membrane known as our lungs actually allows for very rapid assimilation of potential toxicants into the pulmonary system, and therefore rapid assimilation throughout the organism. We're going to try to describe some of the factors affecting distribution. We'll define what is the volume of distribution. How big are we? What do we contain? How do we dilute these toxins that perhaps are very, very violent at very low concentrations, and we dilute them? If you recall back to our discussion about dose and response and therapeutic indices and margins of safety, remember that there are therapeutic concentrations, and we'll talk about some of those. We'll list some of the storage sites. We'll discuss how storage influences toxicant half-life. If we are, in fact, metabolizing, the subject for the next lecture in this series, what can we learn from toxicant half-life and how storage might have an impact? And we'll try and do some case studies to kind of illustrate those particular points. We'll try as well to review these case studies and models of storage and distribution and give you a sense of how to use the information in actual real-life clinical cases. Well, in terms of absorption, it is the primary process of crossing these compartmental barriers. The barriers in terms of the human organism, these are epithelial cell barriers typically that line our lungs, our gastric systems, our skin, for example. The absorption through skin, lung, or intestinal tissue is followed by passage into the interstitial fluid and a distribution then into the other fluids in the cell, outside of the cell, throughout the body. You'll see various representations in human anatomy and physiology textbooks on the volumes of all of these different types of fluids, and this difference has to do with the size of the model. For example, an adult male is going to be significantly different in terms of the volume of distribution than a female child. Okay? Well, this toxicant is absorbed, and then it enters the lymph of the blood system, and then it is mobilized to other parts of the body because the blood flow is very rapid, lymph flow significantly slower, but still a mobilization vehicle. It then, because it has been distributed, can enter local tissue cells. That will have a lot to do about the physical chemical characteristics of the toxicant itself, as well as the types of receptors and tissue types that it passes. You know, for example, we've said many times, lipophilic substances will tend to associate and concentrate in lipophilic tissues or fat tissues. In terms of distribution, we have the lymphatic system. It is encompassed by the lymph capillaries, lymph nodes, tonsils, spleen, thymus, and the lymphocytes. And so we actually can drain fluid. It's a slow drainage fluid. people that have swelling injuries, quite often it's because of a backup of lymph or a rushing of lymph to an injury site. It is a slow circulation as opposed to the cardiovascular system where we have very, very rapid flow. We have nominally in adult 5 liters or plus or minus of body fluids. These are pumped extremely rapidly. The heart, arterial and venous vessels, the capillaries, and the various blood circulatory parts of organs. It's a very, very fast circulation, so the ability of something to get from one part of the body to the other parts of the body is very, very rapid. And this has a lot to do with the blood flow associated with particular organs. For example, in exercise, our muscles can actually get about 60% of the blood flow, as opposed to in rest, our liver gets about 27% of the blood flow, okay, in a first pass from the intestines. And we'll talk about that in terms of distribution and absorption. We have a major distribution vessel in terms of toxicants by the blood. So although the lymphatic system is possible in terms of drainage and movement, the major distribution factor is in fact blood. In the blood system, we have it's made up of fluids and cells within that fluid. It's the major toxicant transport system. In terms of some of the cells, we have the erythrocytes, the red blood cells containing hemoglobin, primarily for gas transport, oxygen in one direction, carbon dioxide in the other. We have the leukocytes, or the white blood cells, and there's many different types of leukocytes, various elements of the immune that make up the immune system. We have platelets. Platelets or thrombocytes are important in terms of clotting mechanisms. Platelets actually are slow in terms of regeneration. Their lifespan is on the order of 10 days, whereas erythrocytes, you might have a lifespan in the organism of about 2 or 3 months. Plasma is the whatever is left, non-cellular fluid. This particularly is made up of inorganic ions, proteins, cell waste material, all of the other stuff that's not on a cellular basis. Quite often it's plasma that we deal with when we talk about volume of distribution or we talk about therapeutic monitoring of drugs. We want to see the concentration in plasma, and so it's a good idea to know in terms of that volume of distribution what exactly we're dealing with and how plasma is actually a relatively small amount of all of the water or the fluids that exist in the human organism. In terms of entering the bloodstream, where it enters can affect the toxicity. In terms of the digestive system, we have sometimes fast, sometimes slow absorption of toxicants depending upon the physical and chemical state of the toxicant. The portal vein, which is the main blood flow pathway from the intestinal system, carries toxicants and as well as nutrients directly to the liver for biosynthesis or biotransformation. It's a major site, the liver is, for detoxification. We get what is called a first pass effect. And this first pass effect has a lot to do with the survival of the organism. What I mean by that is when you eat, you have the nutrients and the molecules of life, your energy substrates. The idea in terms of how we have evolved this way is to allow for a tremendous amount of blood flow to come from the gastrointestinal tract and into the liver for all of the metabolic syntheses that need to happen, the proteins, the enzymes, the glycogen synthesis that needs to happen in the liver. With that process, we also get toxicants carried to the liver, and there is a tremendous capability of the liver, the so-called waste treatment organ of the body, to actually detoxify those chemicals. And we have talked in many cases about the detoxification or biotransformation of toxicants as the conversion of grease to salt, and we'll see that actually in the next lecture. In the respiratory system, it's a very rapid exchange. It goes directly into the pulmonary circulation system, and so there is the potential for rapid entry and rapid intoxication. Airborne contaminants can take down an individual very rapidly. Particulates, whether it be physical irritation such as asbestos or dust particles from silicosis actually can slowly migrate through the lymph system. And typically what happens, it's a function of size. Respired particles greater than about 10 microns can actually be expelled via the mucociliary escalator. Particles that are less than 10 microns but perhaps greater than about 0.2 microns can lodge in the alveoli and actually migrate through cell walls, through the interstitial spaces between cell walls, and in fact be deposited and transported by the lymph system. Particles less than about 0.2 micron actually can be exhaled, that can go into your lungs and be exhaled, and has a lot to do with Brownian motion and just buoyancy, air buoyancy of particles at those very, very small sizes. In terms of the absorption, percutaneous or dermal absorption, it enters through the peripheral blood supply, and it can, in fact, impact organs and tissues and organelles very far away in terms of a systemic impact. Now, some of the factors affecting distribution, as you can well imagine, the physical or chemical properties of the toxicant. Is this a solid, or is it something that is rapidly impacted? If it's immune-mediated, there might be an immune reaction. That immune reaction might, for instance, have an effect in terms of a dermal absorption, for instance, of poison ivy poison. Has a lot to do with the concentration gradient, the volume of distribution, where we have a dose distributed over a certain volume of plasma, giving us a particular concentration. That actually can help us in terms of pharmaceuticals, because we'll be able to identify a clinical or a therapeutic concentration that allows us to maintain that across different body weights of individuals. So we change the dose for children, for perhaps you know, as opposed to a 200-pound adult, to allow for a therapeutic concentration that will do what the particular medicine is supposed to do. The cardiac output to specific tissues is an important factor affecting distribution. Our various organs have differences in terms of cardiac output. Again, I said the liver at rest gets about 27% of the blood flow. The kidneys get a substantial amount of blood flow, as does the brain. But that changes, for instance, during exercise. There are, well, as well as detoxification reactions, these can be specific biotransformations or, for example, protein binding. Albumin is one protein, serum albumin, that will bind and assist in not only the transport of toxicants, but the detoxification and the fact that it is perhaps had its active groups. The toxicants' active groups are actually no more reactive and therefore can be eliminated. There will also be a factor of the tissue sensitivity to the toxicant. Again, we've talked about that adipose tissue will be more sensitive to lipophilic chemical compounds. Particular organs, organelles, will have receptors for different chemicals. Sometimes those receptors will be cross-sensitive to naturally occurring proteins or chemicals such as hormones. And then we also have, in terms of a factor affecting distribution, we have certain barriers that we have talked about. We talked about it in our absorption lectures, the blood-brain barrier, the placental barrier, and these will inhibit migration from one part of the body, perhaps to another. Now, some toxicants can bind to plasma proteins, such as albumin, and this can affect distribution, and it can affect the half-life of a particular compound. If you can imagine that there is some physical distribution dominated by thermodynamics in terms of concentration gradient, where you'll have a free toxicant, and that will be in equilibrium with the bound toxicant on the protein, and it might be available for distribution in some sort of endpoint effect. So at small or low dose concentrations, you might find that your serum albumin or plasma protein binding will actually detoxify in and of itself, and there will only be a minimal toxic endpoint, as opposed to higher doses where you overwhelm that particular system. Plasma concentration is a good indicator of toxicant at the site of action. So when we do a toxicosis analysis, when we are looking for a poison, if you will, in an impacted individual, we'll take a blood sample, we'll spin that down so that we have a plasma sample, and the concentration in that plasma sample will be diagnostic of potential poisoning or intoxication. The apparent volume of distribution, V sub D, in liters is a good way to look at the total volume of body fluids when a toxicant is distributed. Because we can back calculate from V sub D, we can actually back calculate and look at dose and dosage in terms of an individual, because for many toxicants we know relative half-lives, and so we can go do some dose reconstruction experiments. These numbers and these approaches in terms of the volumetric and the physical concentration analysis of toxicants help us a lot in terms of therapeutic monitoring and disease diagnosis. One of the ways that we can take a look at the whole distribution of toxicants in the human body is to examine the distribution and composition of body fluids. And this graphic from a textbook on medical physiology helps us identify the different breakdowns in terms of where our body fluids are in terms of cell, water, interstitial fluid components, extracellular fluids, and plasma, and the amount in terms of how much would appear in an adult male. Recognize that adult males and adult females are going to have different amounts of relative body fluids, and it has a lot to do with the body fat compositions differences between males and females. Now, it's important in terms of the distribution and storage that we identify major organs that are involved in processing of those toxicants. Primary among these organs is distribution to and from the liver. Again, the portal vein allows us, if you remember your anatomy, we actually drain the liver, we drain the gastrointestinal tract straight to the liver. In terms of blood flow, the liver gets about 80% of its blood volume as venous blood coming from the gastrointestinal tract. About 20% is arterial blood. And what this does is it allows the absorbed nutrients from the gastrointestinal tract to be passed to the liver very, very rapidly. And again, a lot of these are associated with energy stores and the components required for biosynthesis of many of the molecules of life. It ensures that the toxicant has a major potential for toxicant interaction at the liver, and we'll talk about hepatotoxicity or target organ toxicity associated with the liver in one of our further lectures. There is a challenge in terms of the liver. The liver was set up for maximum absorption, maximum bioprocessing to use the nutrients, and in some cases reuse nutrients very, very efficiently. There is a system referred to as enterohepatic recirculation. On the website, on your course modules, I have an animation, a cartoon, if you will, of enterohepatic recirculation, the link here on this particular slide for you. But this circulation does, in the case of toxicants, allow for the potential of recycled exposure. What happens is that a toxicant that's in the blood passes to the liver. It gets discharged, sometimes as a bioprocessed conjugate, and we'll talk about conjugation next time. Will get discharged through the bile ducts back into the intestine as a component of the bile. But remember that the gastrointestinal tract is highly vascularized and set up for absorption. Those bioprocessed toxicants as parent compounds, as metabolites, can get reabsorbed and redistributed back into the liver via the portal vein and then repeated through a cycle. The portal vein and its connections being downstream of the upstream bile acid discharge. Okay, so that enterohepatic recirculation allows for this recycled exposure. The recycled exposure can increase the half-life of toxicants, and this has a lot again to do with the reason that the liver is trying to maximize absorption. If we eat something that's energy food, we want to make sure that we maximize our absorption and our utilization of those components. Unfortunately, some of those components that are in our diet actually can be toxins, and they go through this same sort of high efficiency absorption process. This is a bovine liver and gallbladder from a dissection. I just wanted to give you an idea of the size and complexity. Human anatomy is a little bit different, but the functionality is the same. You see the gallbladder down here. It allows for storage in between high concentration or high fat diets. In the human, there's a significant storage capability. People that have their gallbladders removed have less capability to deal with high fat diets. There's a little bit of gastrointestinal upset. In terms of the fine structure, this is about a 5 or 10x micrograph of just a transect across liver tissue. This is not really microscopic. You can make out in here, number one, the large numbers of vascular pathways, things like bile ducts that go in and out. But you'll see a distribution of fine structure here, these liver lobules, as they're called. Each one are essentially independently units, operating units, each with its own vascularization system. It's a collection of hepatocytes, or liver cells, are actually doing the bile processing. Quite often in toxicology, rather than do a study in an animal, an in vitro study is done instead. Animal studies are in vivo in terms of, for instance, looking at the metabolism of a particular toxicant or a pharmaceutical, a food additive perhaps. Quite often, instead of going into animal studies, people will use isolated rat hepatocytes, the actual cells that bioprocess these chemical compounds. And in cell culture, dose these cells with a chemical and look for the particular metabolites coming out of this cell culture. And that's a very strong tool in terms of understanding metabolism from an in vitro experimental protocol. Now, this is a complex formula, if you will, of a distribution endpoint model. What we've tried to do here in the slide is break down distribution, all the possible pathways, in almost an engineering diagram. And so if I have a toxicant that does get absorbed into the organism, it goes through this pathway, and at several points can go in different directions. But as is more typical, it goes simultaneously in multiple directions. In other words, some may be stored, some may be biotransformed, some may be eliminated directly as parent compound. So if we have a toxicant and we go into the storage biotransform formation loop, obviously chemicals that are highly lipophilic will start going into storage in the fat. Some inorganic materials such as lead will start being stored in terms of calcium exchange processes in the bone. In terms of biotransformation, this is where we actually perform chemical reactions via enzymes, via cofactors in our body. Again, we will discuss this in great detail in our next lecture. But we biotransform them. We make those very greasy molecules more polar and therefore more water soluble. These metabolites are then set up for excretion. Now, the toxin itself, as parent compound, can go directly to excretion or perhaps interaction with cells or organelles. And so this gives you an idea of all the different places that a toxicant can go to in terms of processing in vivo in the human body. As it turns out, typically there are multiple pathways available, and it is probably more likely in terms of a toxicant to have multiple metabolites. For example, in terms of urinary excretion, you may find the parent compound in some percent and one major metabolite, two major metabolites, or maybe five or six different metabolites in terms of the total toxic residue in terms of its excretion. And so these total body burden, these elimination distribution models are very, very helpful in understanding a particular compound, how it's being metabolized, what's the relative toxicity of the metabolites. Are the metabolites detoxified or are they toxified, as in some cases where the metabolism process increases the potency via chemical reaction, sometimes, for example, in the liver. Now let's move on to storage, and storage is the accumulation of toxicants in specific tissues, and there's a couple that are kind of the major areas of storage in terms of the body. We'll bind to plasma proteins. This is typically a shorter term storage because of the turnover of blood components. Albumin, serum albumin is the most abundant and common binder in terms of it. Serum albumin is important in terms of transport of nutrients. It's what it's there for. It's about a third to a half of the protein level in your blood. It's used for osmotic pressure regulation. We can also have storage of certain types of chemicals in the bones. These are typically inorganics, such as heavy metals. Lead is a classic bone storage toxicant. On the other side, in terms of that's a cation, on the anionic side, remember that bone is made up of calcium phosphate. Phosphate or oxyanion analogs, such as vanadates, will sometimes store in bones. We have storage potential in the liver, not only in the fatty tissue of the liver, just in terms of ability of certain chemicals to bind on the tissues of the liver. The liver, remember, is important in terms of blood flow and biotransformation. It is a highly regenerable organ. We'll talk about this a little bit in our discussions of hepatotoxicity, but it is one of only a couple places in the body where we have a tremendous amount of potential for regeneration of the original organ. So this organ has the potential to sustain a tremendous amount of damage, and the survivability organism is probably in large part due to the ability of this organ to survive that damage. We have some potential for storage in the kidneys, accumulation of material binding, for instance, of heavy metal moieties on various components of the kidneys, sometimes leading to nephrotoxicity, again, something we'll deal with in our target organ toxicity discussions. We also have the potential to observe storage in fat. Chronically or morbidly obese individuals have a tremendous amount of potential to store a tremendous load or body burden of toxicants in their fat. When we do lipid biopsies or fat biopsies, we find concentrations of lipophilic chemicals like PCBs, some flame retardants, lipophilic or chlorinated hydrocarbon pesticides, insecticides such as DDT, that build up and bioaccumulate throughout the natural world in what some ecologists refer to as the liposphere. Again, going out into nature and looking for all the fat residues in plants and animal tissues. If we have a food chain, there is a potential for accumulation, and in some cases, concentration up the food chain of lipophilic chemical compounds. This is the first of a couple case studies we'll do in this lecture. This was a case study I happen to be involved in Petaluma, California. This has to do with bone storage in chicken. In this particular case, this is a veterinary diagnostic toxicology case. There were laying hens that were in late molt. For those of you that have ever been involved in egg production, egg is a part of the reproductive cycle of the chicken. And in commercial production, controlling that reproductive cycle is important in terms of productivity in most egg-laying operations. To do that, producers will do several things. Number one, because these animals are bred for their production, their high level of egg production, they have to be on very, very high calcium diets. These calcium diets typically are via calcium phosphate or rock phosphate that is mined, or sometimes supplements like oyster shell. If you keep your own chickens, you know that if you're going to have egg layers, you're going to have not only the chicken feed, but you'll need some oyster shell or some other calcium supplement that these animals will crave because of their high metabolism in terms of egg production. Now, what happens in terms of their reproductive cycle to keep a flock of chickens on call, so to speak, in terms of egg production, producers will force a molt. Molt is a part of a bird's reproductive cycle modification. Molts can happen in response to changes in diet, changes in temperature, changes in light, essentially seasonal variations. And to bring, in some cases when there's a commercial production of several thousand birds, bring them simultaneously into molt, for instance, they'll shutter the facility, make it all dark, they'll take them off a feed for a few days, they'll somehow interrupt their physiological cycle, bring them all into molt together, and then they come out of molt ready to get into high production. Now, in terms of commercial egg laying, because these animals are laying many, many eggs, they have a tremendous calcium turnover potential. The major breastbone in a chicken is actually a calcium reserve for egg laying. The amount of calcium turnover is very, very high. And chickens can cycle about 50% of their egg mass in egg production. And again, so this is a requirement of commercial egg laying. In this particular case, the animals actually had a very, very bad molt. They did not come out of molt very easy. There was a bone storage upset in terms of calcium. There was about a 20% death rate. I think it was several thousand chickens total in this particular facility. These animals, because they did not enter their molt the way they should have, actually metabolized, kept metabolizing their body burden of calcium at a very, very high rate without access to their calcium supplement, because this was a forced molt. These animals started losing tremendous amounts of their bone mass. Their bones in their legs were brittle as pencils, easily to be broken. And in terms of follow-up toxicological analysis, materials, the toxicants such as lead and vanadium that were in their bones, where it was actually being released into their blood system. There was high blood lead, high blood vanadium in these particular animals. So again, metabolism of the bone structure in terms of returning some of those inorganic elements into the primary blood flow, thus allowing some potential for intoxication. This case study is another one. This is in a human situation, similar sort of lead mobilization. In this particular case, this was mobilization of bone stores during a thyroid toxicosis. And in this particular case, a 37-year-old female smoker. And this individual had a history of childhood lead exposure, pica or dirt eating, paint chip eating when she was a youth. There was about 7 years earlier, this individual was involved in old house renovation for about 6 months, exposed to a lot of lead dust during those renovation processes. This individual presented with fatigue, cramps, insomnia, weight loss, muscle cramps, and tremor. Her blood lead levels were extremely elevated, about 51 micrograms per deciliter. Normal is typically below 5 micrograms per deciliter. Her EP, or erythrocyte protoporphyrin, which is an indicator of lead exposure, was elevated, and she had a enlarged thyroid on physical examination. Her bone lead levels by X-ray fluorescence were extremely high in two of her different leg bones, 154 and 253 parts per million micrograms per gram, where a normal is 5 to 10. And so her bone stores of lead were very elevated. She did also have an indication of hyperthyroidism. Her hormones, her thyroid hormone levels in terms of blood analyses were very elevated. There was obviously a disease manifestation. This particular disease manifestation was associated with or consistent with Graves' disease. One of the clinical components of Graves' disease is high turnover of bone calcium. People that suffer with this disease typically will have fragile bones. In her particular case, the blood protein that's an indicator of calcium turnover, and this is serum osteocalcin, it was elevated, and that gave an indication that the thyroid problem and the excess amount of thyroid hormone imbalance was leading to a high amount of bone turnover. That bone turnover was releasing stored lead from her bone structures. The thyroidism was treated with a technique called thyroid ablation therapy, where radioactive iodine, iodine-131, is actually dosed to the patient. What it does, it typically kills off the higher, the overactive thyroid cells, and essentially diminishes the output of the thyroid. The dose response in terms of this therapy to its indirect toxicosis and in terms of release of blood lead was significant. 25 weeks later, the blood lead levels were down to 19 micrograms per deciliter. At 52 weeks, a year later, it was down to 17. And so the idea of treating one particular part of the patient or one particular disease manifestation controlling in vivo toxicosis is quite interesting, and this is one of the first cases where these relationships were established in terms of the historical occupational or industrial medicine. What's important as well in distribution and storage of toxicants is the route of exposure. Remember that the GI tract sends the toxicant directly to liver via the portal system, and so we get this first pass detoxication associated with the liver. The GI to lymph system, because we do have some direct transport of chemicals, whether it be nutrients or toxicants, to the lymph system can happen, but it is slower. The respiratory or skin exposure can have greater systemic effects in terms of distribution rapidly around the body. And this rate of metabolism can actually have impact the systemic effects around the organism. Slower metabolism will allow a wider distribution. So if we have a rapid binding, rapid detoxification, a very, very short half-life, that will affect the ability of a toxicant to actually impact receptors distant from the site of the injury. We have at our disposition models that allow us to do a quantitative analysis, kinetic analysis, if you will, as of toxic intoxication. One of the ways we do this is to simplify the organism, complex organism, in terms of various organs. We simplify these as looking at compartmentalizing the body. So if we take a look at the different tissues as compartments, for instance, blood and fat and bone, liver, kidneys, and brain, and we break it down in terms of the compartmental boundaries between those two and establish rates of transport across and then back across once again those boundaries. One of the ways we can do that, if we take all sorts of assumptions, is to simplify towards a one-component open model. We'll let it have first-order kinetics, and as you can see on this graph, the log of the concentration of the toxicant decreases rapidly in a linear fashion in first-order kinetics over time. And that allows us to get an idea of predicting how things will occur in terms of intoxication for toxicants that follow first-order kinetics. Sometimes we have to go a little bit more complex because we have toxicants that can cross boundaries that impact multiple compartments simultaneously. So we'll go to, for instance, a two-compartment open model. an example here, it enters the blood and then goes to another component, in this particular example, the liver, before being excreted or returned. How to do this mathematically is typically more complex. You can see here in this graphic that we've got the amount that's in the blood is decaying over time, but the amount simultaneously that occurs in the liver is increasing prior to some sort of biotransformation before excretion elimination. This helps us, again, to get an idea of the impact of time post-intoxication when these impacts will lead to final excretion. In terms of disposition, this is another case study. This is a veterinary diagnostic toxicology case study. Sheep are very sensitive to copper as a species. These particular sheep had access to a copper sulfate feed supplement in a poisoning episode, non-intentional. Copper, as you know, is a strong oxidizing agent. In sheep, it causes something called an acute hemolytic crisis, where the red blood cells are lysed open. Icterus, hemoglobinuria, where there's actually hemoglobin in the urine. Hemoglobinemia, in terms of the lysed red blood cells in the blood. And then finally, because of the potential impact of copper with some of the proteins in the liver, you get a tubular nephrosis, or in a dying off of the tissue in critical parts of the kidney that allow for balance of bodily fluids. In this particular case, in terms of disposition, you can see abject discoloration of the soft tissues from the hemoglobinemia, or the hemoglobin-free hemoglobin in the blood. It essentially is staining all of the tissues in this right black brown color. In terms of the kidney and the impact of the copper and the hemoglobin, free hemoglobin in the kidney, you see a classic postmortem here of a gunmetal kidney, where what should be a pinkish-red maroon tissue is actually a gunmetal color because of the impacts of the metals from the hemoglobin, iron, and the copper on the specific tissues of this organ. We also, in terms of monitoring distribution, we have structural barriers in the body, and we've talked about some of these in our absorption lecture. We remember that we have the blood-brain barrier. The brain has these specialized cells here shown in this image of astrocytes. Astrocytes are actually a higher fat concentration cell. It limits water-soluble molecules from the capillary endothelium and neurons of the brain. And so, again, an evolutionary structure perhaps to make sure that if we are exposed to something that may impact us, that the brain is perhaps the last organ, the one that's most important in terms of survivability. It's the last organ to perhaps be affected. Again, in terms of evolutionary survival, the placental barrier consists of several cell layers, again, with alternating or enhanced fat contents. It's between the maternal and the fetal circulatory systems. These structures help slow toxicant passage both chemically and structurally, okay? And so they're an important factor affecting distribution of toxicants. For example, knowing this, if you are a pharmaceutical company designer and you are dealing with something that needs to have good entry into the brain in terms of its therapeutic impact, you're going to have to design that molecule so it's got the size and the lipophilicity to be able to cross that barrier, so it'll have a therapeutic concentration at the organ of impact, which in that case might be the brain. This is another case study. Again, this one was a study from a critical review in toxicology, a fairly substantial case. Happened back in 1973 in terms of contamination of the U.S. food supply. It's associated with a chemical compound class called polybrominated biphenyls. You can see it on this structural here that we have the biphenyl structure, and then we have the potential to brominate on the periphery of here numerous times. These particular chemical compounds are analogs of PCBs, which are used in transformers as a dielectric, same sort of very high lipophilicity. These particular chemicals were used in as fire retardants and in a variety of consumer products. It's a very stable process. There can be dehalogenation that can be occur in nature via microbial. It can occur in animals via dehalogenation, again, to enhance the water solubility prior to elimination. Manufacture of these polybrominated biphenyls was actually discontinued in the U.S. in 1976. Before that, though, in 1973, there was an incident where this particular chemical, produced under the trade name of Firemaster, was mixed up at a chemical plant with another chemical that was used as a feed supplement, magnesium oxide. There was a problem in terms of the factory manufacturing these chemicals, in terms of the types of bags each one was stored in. What was happening was that they used some of the wrong bags and tried to essentially write over the top that, in fact, this was a different material. And it ended up with about 10 to 20, 50-pound bags of this polybrominated biphenyl accidentally being sent to the Michigan Farm Bureau Services in place of a feed supplement used in livestock. Feed supplements typically are like any sort of vitamin, it's used in fairly trace amounts, so these 10 to 20, 50-pound bags actually went a long way in terms of potential impact of livestock feed and food. It was not recognized until long after, in fact, because of the toxicosis that was occurring in some of the animals and a little bit of toxicology detective work by veterinarians to backtrace why this particular chemical compound was starting to show up and affect production and the health of dairy cattle. By the time it was discovered in 1974, it had entered the food chain through milk and other dairy products. There's a tremendous human impact as well as animal impact via the food chain. It went through contaminated dairy, beef, swine, sheep, chicken, and eggs. And so the whole animal food system was contaminated in that area. There were about 80 or so farms impacted. I'm sorry, 500 farms as a result, 500 farms in Michigan. The photo on here is a historical image of some of the burial sites associated with managing the polybrominated biphenyl incident. In terms of animal destruction, about 30,000 cattle, 4,500 swine, 1,500 sheep, and 1.5 million chickens were destroyed. Tons of animal feed, tons of processed product in terms of cheese, butter, eggs, and about 34,000 pounds of dried milk products were actually destroyed in response. This was a national incident occurred. There were nightly reports, some follow-up reports, because this actually was fairly invasive in terms of the human food chain. Tremendous numbers of people were exposed. These people were called the Michigan cohort of individuals that were exposed. These people complained of nausea, abdominal pain, some loss of appetite, joint pain, fatigue, and weakness. With these chemicals, there's some concern about long-term effects, endocrine disruption, carcinogenesis. There haven't been a tremendous amount of follow-up to show that there was a direct dose-response relationship in terms of serum or plasma concentrations. There is stronger evidence that some of these may have caused some skin problems, the classic chloracne that's associated with halogenated hydrocarbon exposure. Some workers exposed to PCBs also developed some of the acne. And there has been follow-up in terms of monitoring these populations, especially reproductive age females, in terms of their challenges, and they have seen some second generation impacts, although the dose response direct analysis has been somewhat complicated and somewhat difficult to nurse out of the data. There have been numerous studies. This is one of them from environmental health perspectives on this small table here from that particular publication, because we're talking about distribution and storage. This is an estimate from the data of the half-life from initial serum parts per billion 2 or 5 for two different cases. And this is where these individuals, these are women in exposure scenarios, if their body mass index was less than 23 or greater than or equal to 23. Body mass indicators are an indication of the amount of relative body mass and therefore body fat. Essentially, with PBB being a lipophilic compound stored in the body fat, women that had larger BMI, greater than 23, their half-life in terms of years was on the order of range of 5 to 21 years for the same range for women with less body mass index, less than 23. From 4 to 8 years. And so the idea of storage of this particular compound in tissues is illustrated by this particular table. There were increased rates of neurologic, immunologic, dermatologic, and musculoskeletal effects noted in the exposure cohort. They did not show a particular serum polybrominated biphenyl relationship. There were numerous negative correlation study results. Biological populations are just tough to study. In terms of the exposure, what particular products, this was not a controlled experiment, but it does teach us quite a bit in terms of follow-up and potential impacts on reasonably large populations. One finding was that spontaneous abortion rates were elevated among second-generation women after this particular incident. Well, we can take information like this when we have a clinical toxicosis and use it to develop fairly advanced models for risk assessment. One of the things that we do in toxicology is we actually try to use the clinical literature of poisoning to establish some human relationships of toxicosis in terms of dose response, in terms of distribution, in terms of storage. As we compartmentalize not only the environment but our bodies, we can calculate rates of transfer across particular interfaces, critical interfaces, if you will. As we start modeling, we develop what we might refer to as a proxy for situation or specific clinical data, which we really can't get in humans. We don't do dose response experiments in humans. But we can take the clinical data. We can compare clinical data, for example, to rat studies or other organisms in terms of toxicological trials. And the idea, when we do have sufficient background knowledge, we can put all of this together in a physiologically based pharmacokinetic model. And the idea there is to come up with a computer model such that we can look at the different rates of exposure, dietary exposure distribution within the body, and come up with an endpoint and be able to make some decisions based on that endpoint on the relative risks and benefits. For example, clean up an environmental contaminated material from a site, look at a water system that's contaminated, look at a food product that might be contaminated, and do appropriate risk assessment analysis for humans without having to do clinical trials. Okay, so this gives us a degree of modeling capability which is probably still wrong, but less wrong than just gross estimations. Okay, and the one way you actually truth this, we ground truth these models, is by looking at how it relates to these different clinical cases that might occur via poisoning, suicides, industrial exposures. In terms of one of the most developed models that we have, blood lead is probably the most significant. Tens of millions of dollars have gone into developing this particular model. It's called the Integrated Exposure Uptake Biokinetic Model for Lead in Children, or also known as the IEUBK model. I give two citations here in terms of the web, because this is freeware, my ability to be downloaded. I will require that students in this course actually download IEUBK and also the California Lead Spread. The California Toxic Substance Control Board actually has developed a very simple spreadsheet format as well for lead risk assessment. I actually like it better for food exposure because you can put in there different market basket types of products from your backyard garden. But these can be downloaded. They will be subjects for some of the tests or exams problems in the course. Okay, they're very straightforward. In the case of IEUBK, it's a Windows-driven product, fairly straightforward with a tremendous amount of documentation. We're not going to go through this in lecture because there is so much documentation, and it's a very straightforward process. Lead Spread is another one. Download it, open it up in Excel, and kind of do some demonstrations yourself to know how this works in terms of looking at a set of criteria and determining whether or not that yields an acceptable or unacceptable blood lead level in children. Now let's go through some of the assumptions in the IEUBK model. It does attempt to predict blood lead levels for children primarily exposed to lead in their environment. There is developmental toxicity associated with lead, and we will do that in further lectures, talk about the specific dose response or blood lead levels and how they are indicators of particular pathogenesis. This model does allow the user to input some of these relevant absorption parameters. So if you want to look at, for instance, species-specific absorption of different lead species, it allows you to do that. It allows you to vary different intakes in terms of food, dust, soil exposure. It is interesting that in terms of lead in children, the lead that's in household dust is a primary vector of exposure of lead. You can use these inputs in this model to then rapidly calculate and recalculate the equations associated with lead crossing the various thresholds in terms of the compartments of the body, and it comes up with an estimated potential contribution of blood lead for a hypothetical child or population of children. So it allows you, for instance, to look at a cohort of one-year-olds in terms of how much they eat on a daily and drink on a daily basis, or all kids 6 months to seven-year-olds, or 5 to 7 year-olds. And so from a risk assessment analysis, it's a very potentially very powerful tool. It's not only an index of exposure, but at these levels, we now know that certain levels in childhood blood samples, child blood samples, are indicators of future health problems. IQ development, social skills, there's a tremendous amount of literature associated with the potential negative outcomes, health outcomes associated with childhood lead exposure. Childhood lead concentrations at or above 10 micrograms per deciliter of blood present a risk to children's health. There's actually a proposal right now that is being actively reviewed to reduce this down to 5 micrograms per deciliter in blood. The National Academy of Sciences, among other, are reviewing the need to reduce this down yet further. Over the past several decades, this level has been incrementally reduced as scientists have done dose response analyses, modeling analyses, analyses of outcomes of childhood exposure in lead. In terms of the model itself, there is an exposure component where we compare lead concentrations in food and environmental media with the amount of lead that enters in a child's body, again, crossing that interface between chemistry and biology. The exposure component uses some media-specific consumption rates, and those consumption rates will vary as a function of the age of the child, and so that's all pre-programmed into it. People have done a tremendous amount of study of types of food and how much they make up of a specific individual's diet, and the weight to dietary intake ratio associated with children. There's an uptake component which measures the lead uptake in the lungs, for example, with the digestive tract, how much is bioavailable. As you breathe it in, as you eat it, not all of the load of the lead is necessarily going to be absorbed. And so the bioavailability is studied in this particular component of the model. There is a biokinetic component that shows a transfer of lead between the blood and the other body tissues. And so we know a little bit of how these membranes act, how there's active or passive transport of lead and lead components from the body. There is a probability distribution component, and this allows you to actually take a look at a population and represent the potential impact this across a population. So this isn't an individual, this is a statistical display of information. So you can compare it to known standards to allow for an increased certainty in terms of risk assessment. So for example, the lead concentration greater than a particular standard, in this case 10 micrograms per deciliter, might be the standard for comparison. How do we do that? We do that by simulating some age weight related parameters for all of the intake components, and then it also simulates continual growth over that exposure time period. So we can look at a child that has grown up for 5 years in a lead contaminated environment and get an idea of not only their growth but their assimilation blood lead levels modeled on that basis. It simulates uptake and distribution within the body, as well as elimination. So all of these factors, the kinetics, the membrane transport, are modeled with the best available knowledge that we have. The model is intended to help estimate some of the child long-term exposure to lead in and out around the residence. It allows for provision of an accurate assessment of some average lead, blood lead concentration values in blood for various different age groups, and it does have a provision to provide for doing a risk assessment associated with hypothetical children. It does allow us to predict likely changes in response to concentrations and the impact of modifying those concentrations, for instance, cleaning up the water, cleaning up the soil, cleaning up the local food system. It allows us to look at the impacts of all of those different activities in removing the source and the most important source in terms of the exposure in that particular site. It is designed to help us facilitate, calculate the risk of elevated blood lead levels and how we might be doing better in terms of applying a fixed resources, the budget that we have, for instance, in managing a community that is exposed to higher than background lead levels and having the greatest impact in terms of reducing the childhood blood lead levels. To finish up here, I'm not going to open up the software and show you this software. Again, it's pretty straightforward. There's a lot of defaults in this. It's a Windows-driven program, fairly easy to operate. In my demonstration here, I took the outdoor air lead concentration as default in the software. Again, you can change that. The concentration in drinking water I just left as the default, which is pretty much background. For this particular environment, I did a highly contaminated soil lead area. It was about 800 parts per million. The dust levels that were generated by the area soil were default. It's calculated from the regional soil levels. The maternal blood lead level, we were having moms that really were at the background level of 10 micrograms per deciliter and other default values in there. And I just wanted to take a look at a distribution probability for 1 to 2 year olds, okay, for just a small age group. My result showed us that 51% in this particular environment, this in particular town that had contaminated soil, 51% of these children would have blood lead levels greater than 10 micrograms per deciliter. This graphic right here gives us the probability distribution. Here's our 10 microgram per deciliter standard, and you can see that significant amounts of these children are going to have blood lead levels that extend out here into the 15, 20, 25, and even 30 micrograms per deciliter range, where we get the potential for fairly acute health impacts. So that gives you a sense of the distribution and storage of toxicants as kind of the next step on the pathway of intoxication. Next time, what we'll do is follow this in the whole domain of biotransformation and elimination. What happens in terms of the physiological and chemical, biochemical consequences of chemicals within the body, and how they enter this stream of chemical processes and bioprocesses that actually enable us to manage intoxication or potential intoxication from endogenous sources, for example, the normal low-level toxicants that occur in natural foods. Until that time, thank you. We'll see you again.